Hello, the bridge. Hello.
Hello. Am I meant to be talking to Richard at WCOOFM?
John, this is Richard. I can recognize that voice anywhere, and thank you so much for calling.
Oh, my dear chap. I do apologize for being a bit late. I was hoping to see my wife and daughter off to a horse show, but they still haven't gone, and I thought I'd better do it, better call you now and forgo the joys of the family.
Well, I guess duty calls, but thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. It's a big thrill and an honor to speak with you, and just really excited to talk with you. So we're going to just dive right in right here, because you're the only actor to appear in the Bond, Indiana Jones, and Lord of the Rings franchises, and yet here you are playing a sociopathic Cupid. You're a serious actor. I'm just sort of wondering, how did you feel when they approached you with the idea for this role in the new movie Bad Cupid that opens Valentine's weekend?
Well, I loved it. I loved the script. I like the idea of a Cupid having grown up, still doing the job, hating people, just to keep himself interested at all and keep the job going, inventing new ways of arranging the proper conjunction of the right person with the right person. It's he's wonderful. He's a wonderful character. Yes, I mean, there's a slight sort of sociopathic quality about him. I mean, if you consider kidnap, violence, murder threats, things like that,
It seems like you had a lot of fun.
Violent things. If you consider those psychopathic, yes, I suppose you could say, in a way, he is. He has some issues, I think. But let's face it, if you'd been doing the job for 2,000 plus odd years, wouldn't you feel a little bit irritated? Because every human has the same wretched compulsion to fall in love with the wrong person. It comes with the job, I suppose.
Well, when somebody thinks about Cupid, they think about a little guy with wings and arrows shooting, and there's probably never been a Cupid like this before. And I know it's an awesome comic thing to do, and already an incredible career, but what was the approach you brought to playing Cupid? I mean, let me just describe for our listeners that it tells the story of love held hostage as an unhinged Cupid, played by Mr. John Rhys-Davies here. It takes a heroic and heartbroken guy on a romantic rival on a comic kidnapping. And it's really funny, but I'm just wondering, what did you bring to the role versus what was already on the script? Because you seemed like you had a blast doing the movie.
To be honest with you, I try to have a blast on every job that I do. I mean, you know, one day the phone will stop ringing. Now, I won't know that has actually happened. I'll be still saying to you, well, of course, yes, it has been a bit quiet the last year or two, but you know, I had a conversation with my manager only the other day, and he assured me that I'm really at the top of about four lists for some serious films. But I won't ever know that it's all gone, that it's done, that it's finished, that it's over. And so the only way that I cope with that is by assuming that this is the last job.
That's sort of like living every day as if it were your last, for one day you shall be right. And that's like taking every job as if it's your last job.
That's right. And so I tend to have a blast on films. And when you get into the right mindset, and when it costs nothing to be brave or be adventurous or anything like that. You know, if it's the last job, it's the last job. Let's have fun. Let's encourage those around us to be creative. And for old actors, you know, to pass on the folklore of acting and teach them about responsibility to each other and service to the script. The only thing an actor or a writer or an entertainer or has to understand is that great adage, the drama's laws the drama's patrons give, and we who live to please must please to live. It's the audience.
Well, I mean, you've been a character actor and esteem for decades, and you've done most of the work of Shakespeare. You're a serious thespian, but I got to believe it's a lot of fun to maybe play against type to some extent when you're playing this outrageous Cupid in the movie Bad Cupid. It's got to be fun to do that.
Well, you know, it's nice to be able to ring the changes. Most producers are not terribly adventurous. Most producers want you to recreate for them the part that you were last most successful in, because that way they think they're going to earn money on their film, their story. You know, they have a right to earn money in return for their people. But actors, you know, normally up until this last year, you know, there was probably at least a script a week that came in, you know, some of which you have to very gently say to the author, well, this is all very well, but, you know, you don't need to put pictures in it in order to sell your story. And, you know, there are sort of standard, frequently there are opportunities to do something different. And
this is different.
And when they come along, one should.
It's just really a hilarious thing to see you, you know, taking the groom of a wedding and bound gagging and stuffing them into a bathroom stall and then trying to find true love or a capital crime. I don't want to spoil too much for people who haven't seen Bad Cupid, but I can just tell how much fun you had doing that and sort of playing against type. But you have such a distinctive voice that your presence on screen. I mean, look, I remember when you were in Shogun back in 1980. So, I can remember that your presence on screen has always been something that has been rather commanding. And to think of Cupid, John Rhys-Davies is not the first person to think of. And I think that's why it's so funny, because it's obvious that you're having a blast with it, and it seems to play against type somewhat.
Yes, and it's a plausible idea for Cupid, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I'm hoping that this one's going to be successful enough for us to be able to do a few more Cupids. I think I'm trying to get a bee out of this door without stressing him too much. Come on, old fella. Yes, I mean, you can imagine this Cupid in 15th century or 16th century,
yes,
Italy.
Yes.
You can see him in the 18th century in the French Revolution, and there are a lot of potentials for a grumpy older Cupid, you know, you may see him looking indeed a bit younger than he was. Ah, this is my wife coming up to me, intending to give me a kiss, I imagine, which means she's probably off.
Go right ahead. I don't want to interrupt.
Very, very good. No, I'll wave them off.
Well, I should mention to people, I mean, you talk about the possibility of seeing other Cupids down the road from what Bad Cupid is going to be when it launches Valentine's weekend. You've had a few sequels in your career. Four movies nominated for the Oscar for Best Picture, and it is the 20th anniversary this year of The Lord of the Rings. I saw Viggo Mortensen on the Colbert, Late Night with Stephen Colbert, talking about reunions and getting together with some of the cast members and stuff. And as the guy who did just an amazing job of Gimli, the dwarf, in Lord of the Rings, the trilogy, do you have a chance to see any of the cast? Do you keep in touch with any of them or had any kind of reunions? I imagine the whole thing is just one of those kind of things that gives you permagrin to sit back and think about the whole joy of making that movie.
Yes, indeed,
and the whole thing.
Yes, it does. A Zoom online thing with all of us, and it was great fun. I just got rid of the bee as well. So sorry about that.
Now
I'm focused back on the conversation. I beg your pardon.
That's fine.
Right.
Can you believe it's been 20 years since you did all that?
Viggo is wonderful. I'm glad he was on Colbert.
Yes. And just talking about how joyous the whole thing was in doing it, and then and over the years, the decades, the reception to the movies, and then the unity of the fellowship, if you will.
It was a brilliant piece of casting, and the cast was uniformly superb, just faultless casting, superb direction, extraordinary writing, you know, and this little chap, Jackson, who'd done a couple of little movies in New Zealand and really thinks he's got what it takes to make Lord of the Rings? Come on. He created an entire film industry to serve his vision.
Mm-hmm.
He did more to put New Zealand on the map of the world than any other man since Captain Cook.
And you really lost 70 pounds and had to endure the makeup that you were allergic to in that movie?
My dear boy, interviewers always get these things wrong.
Okay, great.
No.
Correct
what
me.
What I originally said was, by the time they put the uniform on me, you know, the layers to give me the bulk and that
right.
sort of thing, then the armor, then the 14-pound boots, then the 14-pound helmet, jeez, then the axes and things like that, I was 70 pounds heavier.
And a foot or
and
two shorter.
Jackson would say right now, run up the mountain. yes, well, and so surprisingly enough, when they said, would you like to be in The Hobbit? I said, no. No. Why would I want to be one of 13 when I have been one of one? But you see, in The Hobbit, you see how the makeup changed so much.
Yes, yes.
I mean, barely any of them had any. There were only two good-looking ones anyway, and the rest didn't matter as far. You know, you could tell that was the thinking back in L.A. I mean, I would love to have been in those meetings. You know, all right, now who's going to play the girl? There isn't a girl in the story. Well, what do you mean there isn't a girl in the story? There must be a girl in the story. I mean, you can't have a story without her. We can't make a movie. I mean, well, what are these guys? They're dwarves. How many of them? 13 of them. You've got 13 dwarves, and they're all going to look like John Rhys Davies, for God's sake. Find a girl. Get some girls in there. We got to get some world girls. And forget about the dwarves. Find me two handsome men. Make them the main dwarves. You know, give them a little sort of odd bit of beard or something like that. It doesn't matter about the other 11, you know. Damn me. These guys have no idea how to make a movie, do they? No idea. No. You can imagine that sort of conversation going on, can't you?
Yes, I would imagine now you have cemented your legacy as probably the most famous dwarf, maybe in movie history.
Well, I like to think that. I think Gimli is he is extraordinarily loved by people.
Yes.
And I think there are three reasons for that, really. One is that he represents what is worst in us that we recognize. You know, the obstinacy, the arrogance, the aggression, the xenophobia, the hostility to new ideas, people and things. And what we hope is the best of us, which is, you know, he's protective of those who are smaller than him. You know, he is brave. He is
fearless.
Certainty of death.
He's fearless.
Small chance of success. What for? there's that. He will charge into, you know, a thousand orcs or things like that. You know, without fear, but he's a little bit superstitious. You know, there are spooky things out there, you know, and you've got to be very careful with those things because, you know, they say there is a witch in this forest, you know, and anyone who looks upon her is never the same again. And of course, he's right. When he does meet Galadriel, he falls deeply and inescapably in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember when Legolas asks him what gift she gave him. He says, I asked for one strand of her golden hair. She gave me three. That's love.
Well, and That's, and, I think, part of the reason why you were saying he's a beloved character and still remains so. And I'm just wondering, you mentioned that there was a conversation about maybe you being in The Hobbit or something and whatever, or consideration having been Gimli in The Lord of the Rings. Was there ever a conversation about you reprising Sala in the fourth indie movie or the supposed fifth one that may be coming, if you could tell us?
yes, there was a conversation about the fourth one, and I think the idea was that I came in, it was a bit of green screen, come in, sit down, and clap in the wedding sort of thing, and they were going to cut me into that.
Ah, okay.
I didn't think I wanted to do that, really. I think the character's worth a bit more than that.
Absolutely. And speaking of Beloved, I read somewhere where you actually still get people who approach you and want you to sing the song from Gilbert and Sullivan that you sang in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
A British tar is a soaring soul, as free as a mountain bird. His energetic fist should be ready to resist a dictatorial word.
I'm taking that as a yes. from HMS Pinafore, after Karen Allen kisses you in the movie. That's just classic. And, we just had last year the passing of Sean Connery, and you had a chance to work with him in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, and just what a great man, you know?
I also had a chance to work with him in something that we did many years ago called Sword of the Valiant, which was a version, a sort of cinematic version of Gawain and the Green Knight. And I had a chance to meet Connery there for the first time. We talk about alpha males. Mm-hmm. Connery was a real alpha male. You know, there was a street toughness there that, men saw and recognized and women loved. And I tell you, when those eyes twinkled and, you know, that smile came on those rather tough, mean lips, there wasn't a girl between 14 and 95 who didn't go, ooh. He was a real alpha, though we use the term far too frequently. There aren't really, that many absolutely dominant alphas.
Well, a truly great man and a great actor, and I know it had to be a blast to work with him and Harrison Ford. And obviously,
he and Mike Caine really are the two great film stars of their generation. Although we have many fine and things like that, I don't know that they command quite the respect that that Connery and Caine have commanded.
They don't make them like that anymore, they're rare breeds, and that's why I was mentioning just the fact that your voice, speaking of commanding, I mean, when you speak, there is a commanding. I mean, I know that you worked at London's Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts and pursuing your acting and writing and things there, but that's why seeing you play the sort of on the edge, unhinged Cupid was just so classic. And I have to ask, I'm talking to you right now. You're in New Zealand, correct?
I'm in New Zealand. I had a return ticket that I had a show to do early last year, which I did, and took me back to England. It was looking pretty clear that I'd miss out on Christmas if I didn't use the darn ticket and come back. Mm-hmm. And I found just the right lull in time and managed to get to book here you have government enforced quarantine.
Absolutely, and that's what I was going to ask you about, is the COVID situation in New Zealand has been handled so much differently than virtually any other part of the world, and with very positive results. I'm wondering.
I have a home on the Isle of Man,
right?
Again, we have no COVID in the Isle of Man at the moment. We have none in New Zealand. There are people still coming into managed quarantine who develop the symptoms while they're here, and that is true of the Isle of Man too. But the whole you can't start comparing one country's conduct
right
with over codeine with another. I mean, nobody goes to anywhere via New Zealand or the Isle of Man, for that matter. Right. They're off the beaten. They're the end of the journey rather than the transit zone. So that's one great thing. The other thing is, of course, the virus is a very deceptive virus because right at the beginning, you couldn't work out, well, yes, it is a lethal thing. What is its level of lethality? And that's very, it's very hard for governments to judge. Now, if we'd had a massive outbreak of something like Ebola, then all governments would, within a matter of days, have been closing borders, shutting down the economy and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. When you've only got something like a 1.5 or somewhere between 1 and 3 per, 1,000 or 10,000 people dying, if you're seen to overreact, then you're crippling the economy. If you're seen to underreact, then you have no care mm-hmm. for the people. It's an impossible situation to get right unless you're very lucky.
And unlike anything anyone has lived through,
like the Isle of Man or New Zealand, mm-hmm. are very lucky.
Well, let me ask you about that just from the standpoint of we here in Charleston, South Carolina, a beautiful town named the number one city in the world for a number of years because it's just a very unique place along the Atlantic coast of North America here in the United States. But can you describe in some way the beauty that is New Zealand for those who've seen it on film in the Lord of the Rings movies or whatever, but not to see it in person? Can you describe just how beautiful it is?
Let me step out on my deck a little bit.
Okay.
What a pity we're not, we haven't got a video thing. I'm out on the deck now. You can probably hear the cicadas.
I could hear the birds, yes.
Screeching a little bit. I'm looking down this hill, and 100 yards away is the lake. Across the lake, there is an island, and then on the other side, there are the hills going down to the lake, which are all bare. And beyond them, there are further hills, and there is a house over there, isn't there? I think there's a house over there. Yeah, oh, there's a house over there, too. Yeah, there must be at least 3 or 4 houses in the proximity, across the lake. I mean, anywhere between a half a mile and a mile away, or maybe 2 miles away. Right now, where I am is just about heaven on earth. New Zealand was the ideal place to shoot Lord of the Rings because the fauna is different. When I say different, it's really the flora that is different.
It's as unique as anywhere in the world. And then you mentioned he launched a cottage industry.
New Zealand separated from Gondwana land before the evolution of mammals. So there were no mammals in New Zealand up until the Maori arrived in about 1400. And they brought pigs and rats, of course, and possibly cats. Certainly the English brought cats. We do have some silly imports. In the early 1920s, somebody said to the chief veterinary officer in New Zealand, why don't we import things like possums from Australia to New Zealand? Because we lack, natural fauna. He said, well, I can't see why we don't. Now, of course, possums are a real pest. In 1999, which was the last and only time I ever saw a figure, they were consuming 26,000 tons of wood a night. We had a curious communist called Smith, a man who carried class warfare on his shoulders from England to New Zealand. He liked his fishing in England, and in England, he considered coarse fishing the only thing that the ordinary English person could do, because you needed quite a lot of money to do the upper class thing of, catching trout and stuff like that, fly fishing, rich man's sport. Anyway, he carried the badge of class injustice to New Zealand. The early New Zealanders had brought from Scotland and Wales and places like that their trout, and they'd introduced the trout here. And they may have even introduced salmon, but I may be talking off the top of my hat. He decided that what New Zealand wanted was more coarse fishing. So he introduced perch and pike, not so much pike, but basically carp. And carp, he put carp in every virtuous stream that he could visit in the course of his lifetime in New Zealand. They have multiplied, and carp are bottom feeders. When they feed, they stir up mud at the bottom. It clouds the water. It stops the sunlight getting in. It kills the plants, and areas become deoxygenated. His introduction of some fish into some localities have actually completely wiped out the indigenous species of fishes there. When you get single-issue fanatics like that, the damage they can do in the pursuit of their dream of equality and improving the environment and things like that can be quite catastrophic. An ecosystem is a very complicated thing, and to imagine that you're effecting a beneficial change by doing your own thing unilaterally is a fallacy that should be widely discouraged.
Well, I was going to say, John, that it is such a thrill to talk to you, but I think I'd rather say that it's such a thrill to listen to you and to have this conversation with you.
I do sympathize with you, my dear boy. My wife says interviewing me is hopeless because I have no idea of a soundbite.
I don't. You know what, though?
I
do not use the word interview. It's a conversation. And wherever it goes and whatever we talk about, it's always great to have a great conversation. And it especially is to do so with you. And it's just a real thrill. And again, this is a guy who plays Cupid, a man on a mission to ensure true love always wins, or at least short of that, someone's going to die trying. Not that he cares, because some better beware, because if anyone who gets in his way, especially anyone he's actually trying to help, beware. John Rhys Davies, it is such a thrill to talk to you, and I have a feeling that we could talk for a long time about all kinds of stuff, and it would be fascinating. But I just really appreciate you taking the time, and I can't wait for everybody to see the movie Bad Cupid when it comes out Valentine's weekend. But thank you
You're very generous, and I just want to say to all of you who are having a really hard time over this, stay the course, be of good courage, and we will get through it. You know, we are mankind. We have got through the Ice Age. We have got through all the catastrophes that the world could throw at us, and we have survived. And we shall this one too.
It sounds like it sounds like it has more gravitas when you're saying it and when it comes from you. So we are so appreciative of all the great roles and memories and feelings and emotions that you have elicited from us over the decades, and we'll be laughing with you as Cupid in Bad Cupid. And thank you for spending some time with us.
It's been my pleasure.
John, take care and stay safe. And again, thank you so much.
Bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.